We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you by Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
And welcome to our panel on modern Jewish love. Just by way of introduction, all present studies show that contemporary adults are dating longer. They're having sexual relationships at a younger age, and they're marrying later than did people of previous generations. Some of that obviously has to do with birth control and the severing of what was once an almost automatic link between sexuality and pregnancy. And some of it pertains to the different personal values and social mores that people have in the wake of the sexual revolution. And all of this cannot have failed to have had an impact on orthodoxy. We wanted to bring together our speakers tonight to talk about issues in modern Jewish romance, dating, sexuality, and continue that up with individual sessions tomorrow morning. I wanted to introduce you to the people on the panel now. To my immediate right is Dr. Jenny Rosenfeld, who recently made Aliyah and lives in Jerusalem, is currently a junior fellow at the Sholem Hartman Institute. And prior to making Aliyah, Dr. Rosenfeld was the co-founder and director of Tselem. And Tselem was a special project of the Yeshiva University Center for the Jewish Future, and its mission was to make more educational resources in the realms of intimacy and sexuality available to the Orthodox community. Dr. Rosenfeld has a PhD in English from the City University of New York Graduate Center, where she was a Wexner Graduate Fellow, and her dissertation was on Talmudic rereadings towards a modern Orthodox sexual ethic. To my immediate left, Rabbi Dr. Tzvi Blanchard, who is the Director of Organizational Development at CLUL, which is the National Jewish Center for Leading and Learning and Leadership. He directs CLUL's internship program, and he has a double PhD in psychology and philosophy. He's taught philosophy at Washington, at Northwestern and Loyola Universities, as well as the Drisha Institute for Women, the Jewish Theological Seminary, and the Wexner Heritage Foundation. He's a popular speaker in the United States. He's been on television, on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and other media events, and is the co-author of Embracing Life and Facing Death, A Jewish Guide to Palliative Care. To his left, Dr. Nomi Mark, who's a psychotherapist in private practice in New York City, where she specializes in work with couples and families. She was trained at the Ackerman Institute for the Family in New York City and at Columbia University School of Social Work. She's an adjunct clinical professor of social work at Columbia, a faculty member at the Institute of Psychosocial Oncology, and has many other work accomplishments to speak of. We wanted to bring everybody here tonight and talk about some pretty difficult issues that face both the Orthodox and the wider Jewish community in the realm of dating and marriage. And I wanted to pick up on the thought that I began with, which is how does a traditional Jew, we'll start with that, work out this problem of sexuality in the face of later marriage? Because if you answer, well, just avoid sex and marry young, there is a problem of individuals who may not be emotionally, not to mention financially, ready for that kind of commitment. If, on the other hand, you say, no, don't marry young, wait a few years until you're ready, how does that reconcile with clearly burgeoning sexual pressure, especially in the wake of the halakha's obvious restrictions on premarital sexual expression? So there is a kind of bind that young Orthodox people find themselves in, and that's where we want to begin.
So this very question, which Elliot just asked, is really the question that motivated me to write my dissertation on this topic, because you have this double bind, this conflict that faces hundreds, thousands of Orthodox and committed Orthodox Jews. I think that's something that's important to stress, because people who don't have a strong commitment to the halakha aren't going to feel that double bind the same way that people who do have that commitment feel it. So what I've kind of suggested, and I hope, I assume others will have different solutions, because obviously nothing is going to work for everyone, but I think that it's very important at this time to look outside of the halachic realm, towards the realm of Jewish ethics, to try to find, using Jewish sources, a sexual ethic that could speak to Orthodox Jews today from within this conflict. And the ethic isn't meant to contradict the halacha, chas v'shalom, it's just meant to be a parallel realm where someone who is or isn't observing the halacha can still draw from the ethical realm and bring that into their relationships, and maybe that could be a starting point.
I'm not sure I follow. In other words, okay. what could be brought in that would be helpful?
Okay, so basically, to, I guess, get a little bit more specific, some of the conflicts that Orthodox singles are facing in terms of issues of guilt about violation of the halacha in terms of premarital sexual activity at whatever degree, I think could be helped by bringing in ideas from the Gemara or from Hasidut, which I've worked on specifically and I guess we'll be talking a little bit more about tomorrow, to help people and basically say to them, even if you are violating the halacha, here are some other aspects of Judaism that you can bring into your relationship. So, for example, in the realm of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, between man and fellow man, or woman and man, there's other aspects other than the halachic restrictions that can be brought in and things that people can observe, even in violation of the halacha.
Do you want to comment on that? I'm certainly enormously sympathetic with the idea that there needs to be some kind of an alternative to what I would call the halachot that have to do with specifically rules about touching and contact. I'm not as convinced as you are that there isn't something within the halachic system that doesn't address this directly. For example, there are rules about how we are supposed to treat each other that exist within halacha that are not a matter of external ethical concerns. The use of coercion or deception, manipulation is prohibited. There are mitzvot that have to do with the avtala riacha kamocha. There are a whole set of halachic concerns that if you were to say, what's the appropriate way to relate to somebody in a caring and supportive relationship, the halacha would provide guidance. You wouldn't have to step outside the halacha in order to get that guidance. So although I'm sympathetic to looking at additional sources beyond it, I would suggest also that we should put a lot more energy into talking about what a Jewish sexual ethic looks like that grows out of halacha as well, and not focus entirely on the technical question of negiah, for example, in sexuality, and turn instead to other areas of human relationships.
Okay,
so could you specify what you'd be talking about there?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, let's be as direct as possible about
it.
There's a good deal of premarital sexual behavior that involves sometimes self-deception or deception of others, the use of coercion to get people to do things that otherwise they wouldn't do. That issue has to be faced relatively strongly, especially for younger people. We're not talking about people 28 years old, but if you're talking about people between the ages of, say, 18 and 26, okay. There's often a good deal of a lack of honesty about what people really are looking for in relationships, an unwillingness to be completely candid about what you're willing or not willing to do as a part of this relationship. And let's be direct, self-exploitative relationships in which people use each other for mutual benefit, but having nothing to do from the Torah point of view with what an ideal intimate relationship should be about. And those things would all come under the heading, no different heading than if you were to exploit somebody to get money out of them, exploit somebody to get a prestige out of them. Exploiting somebody by the use of sexuality, for example, in order to get self-gratification or to become an important person in a crowd or to be seen as an attractive person. Well, those are powerful psychological motivations. In the halakha, they are extremely limiting. With the point of knowing other people and getting to know them has nothing to do with making yourself feel important or desirable. It has to do with other things as well. So I'd go directly to that. There would have to be a sense that the relationship really wasn't one in which people were kidding themselves. That's not allowed in halacha.
Okay, so let's say they weren't kidding themselves. So you have two people. You're talking about a premarital relationship here,
correct?
So two people get together in a premarital relationship. They're both observant. What you seem to be calling for is that they should be candid with each other about their sexual aims, their romantic aims, their commitment to aims, let's say. And what happens after they're candid?
They also need to, there are responsibilities to take care of people that you've committed yourself to. There are all kinds of responsibilities providing for the emotional well-being of others. If I'm in a position that somebody trusts me and relies on me, then I have to be there to listen to them, to care about them, to be there when things are difficult. They can't be there just because I have a good time dating them. They also have to be, I have to take care of them the same way I would, in many ways, the same halachot that the Jewish sexual ethics also apply in marriage. You don't get married and all of a sudden there are no ethical responsibilities for spouses. You can't compel a spouse into a sexual relationship. You've got to take care of that person. You've got to care about that person. You have to be there for them. And it seems to me that that exists premaritally as well as postmaritally. That's not about whether you're, most of what Jewish sex is about has nothing to do with negiah. It has to do with, do I care about you? Am I there for you? Does it matter to me how you feel? How do you feel? Well, just the same things you'd care about if you're married to the person. That's going to be there 6 months before, a year before you even think about marrying them.
If I could just jump in, I think that that's a critical point that sometimes gets lost. In other words, it's obvious to us that within marriage, you know, there needs to be a sexual ethic. But I think that a lot of times with singles, the focus becomes so zeroed in on the issue of negiah and are you shomer negiah, aren't you shomer negiah, that we don't get past that.
Right.
To the step of, you know, if you're not being shomer negiah, then there's a whole set of ethics. And it's true, a lot of them are within the halacha. A lot of them are also just, you know, can be learned out from reading sugyot, just seeing how to care for the other, what does it mean to treat the other with respect and kavod habrios. Those things also need to be part of any sexual relationship, right, regardless of whether it's before marriage or after marriage. And I think that sometimes that gets lost. And I think sometimes in premarital sexuality especially, the community plays a role in that because it kind of heaps so much guilt upon people that they're just focused on, you know, am I violating the halacha? Am I not violating the halacha? And they kind of aren't able to stop and say, wait, I'm interacting with a human being. Let me think about that whole realm of the haftal arecha kamocha.
Exactly.
So here, though, it would sound like one question would be, where would they learn that from? So, I mean, this takes us really into the realm of education. Should we be teaching young people, formally or informally, in school? Where would be the opportunity to educate them about these kinds of ethics? And once you do, so let's say you start talking in schools about how you should treat your partner, it kind of opens up a whole sort of Pandora's box there. Should the educational system deal with these things directly, frontally? In other words, there would be courses or curricula. Mm-hmm. What's your feeling about that? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think that the educational system has to tackle this issue. I mean, I've spoken with a lot of people who say, you know, it's the role of the parents and not the role of the school. But I think, and I won't take a show of hands, but a significant percentage of parents are probably uncomfortable broaching this issue with their kids, and I think that therefore it has to fall back firstly upon the school to institute these type of curricula from a young age. Now, obviously, it needs to happen at an age-appropriate level, and the type of curriculum that I would think appropriate for, you know, a group of singles in their 20s or singles in their 30s isn't the same curriculum that I'd introduce in a third-grade class. But I think that the discussion has to begin at a young age so that it's not kind of emerging, you know, yesh me'ayin later on.
And there are schools that are beginning to institute this curriculum on a high school level, mm-hmm. where they do talk about issues of human sexuality and relationship-oriented sexuality. So there, it is beginning to happen in some Shiva day schools.
What's the nature of the education? In other words, what age does it start, and what do they talk about?
Well, I believe, and if any of you know this more directly than I do, please let me know later. I believe in Ramaz, in the junior year and senior year, I believe there's a class called Ask the Rabbi, at least there used to be, with Rabbi Luxine, where the students were encouraged to ask questions and to be, and he was pretty open about allowing pretty much any topic that was brought up, he addressed in the classroom, as well as covering the stuff curricula. So he created a context where the students could feel like there's a safe place to talk about some of the questions that were on their mind.
And how frank do you think we should be in these matters? When kids ask specific, in educational situations, when kids ask specific questions,
even about specific sexual practices, be it masturbation, be it premarital sexual relationships. Should they be allowed to ask those questions in class? And what should be the attitude of the educator when that comes up? Because I can tell you my personal experience is it comes up all the time. I'm asked this constantly from religious kids and not religious kids every year. And what always strikes me when I'm asked is that there's no formal sort of, so I'm doing it sort of ad hoc all the time. There's no formal system, no formal curriculum to deal with this. So it really just ends up being that kind of personalized thing. And I'm not sure I love the whole idea of the personalized thing, you know.
Yeah, I just want to add, you know, I think there's a gender difference also between how girls and teenage girls experience this question and how boys do. I remember I once did a workshop on this, on sexuality at a religious girls' school in the New York area. And the girls were seniors in high school. And from the girls' perspective, what the pressure they described was having to conform to media norms of beauty and having to conform to what the boys with whom they interacted, their notions of what it meant to be a sexual being and feeling pressure to live up to these expectations of the boys. And it was less about their own sexual impulses than it was about having to meet the expectations of what the boys wanted from them. And that was concerning. You know, so I think we have to pay attention to the gender questions here, too. I think it's very different for the girls than it is for the boys at that age.
So one thing that I would just want to say is in terms of whether the question should be asked, I think that if kids have these questions, we have to hear the questions. I recently also just spoke to a group of senior girls at a high school in, you know, the New York City area. And I came out of, and all the teachers were kind of banned from the room so that the girls would really be able to be honest. And I came out and one of the teachers said to me, you know, you wouldn't believe what one girl asked me. And shame on her that she's asking that question. And I thought to myself, that's not the right response. We have to take that question seriously and then ask ourselves, you know, well, what are we doing wrong as a community if we don't want them to be asking that question, or what can we do to really address it? And one thing I just wanted to mention in regard to the previous question that you asked in terms of what curricula are out there, is a curriculum that was written by Yocheved Debo and Dr. Anna Rubel called Life Values and Intimacy Education, which is a comprehensive curriculum that includes sexual education and life values and the general realm of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro and the Jewish values that inform those areas. Mm-hmm. And it's a curriculum for grades 3 through 12. Mm-hmm. And the elementary school volume was just published by Ktav several months ago, and through Tselem, the curriculum has been piloted at SAR Academy in New York and Yeshivat Noam as well. So
in other words, even in grade 3, you're talking about somebody who's approximately 9 years old, would start having a rudimentary education, obviously not a kind of explicit education,
right?
But and we would keep this consistent. In other words, it would be a component every grade, every year, until they graduate high school.
Exactly, which gives it the opportunity, kind of, it starts before the issues emerge, because when you talk about introducing a curriculum for high school seniors, oftentimes the wrong messages have been absorbed, whatever has been done, and it's very hard to undo. And so starting in third grade, obviously at an age-appropriate level, you have the opportunity to really start, you know, almost from a blank slate, and then build upon it year after year to imbue healthy messages from the start.
Let me take a less popular position, or at least the one that I suspect in the way you're asking these questions you're not as sympathetic with. That is, to what extent are we supposed to see human sexuality as removed from or a separate area for study? Now, I know that in the American educational system, at least, there's been a tendency to focus on it as a specialty, some other a set of unique questions that have to do with human sexuality, which are removed from other questions of human relationships. I want to suggest that, in fact, from the point of view of the Torah, that is not the best way to proceed, and that human sexuality is one among many different ways in which human beings establish important intimate relationships. What I like about the suggestion in the new curriculum is that it falls under a set of ongoing questions of intimacy of all sorts and concerns. And I think one of the mistakes that the post-60s approach to human sexuality in North America has been about, that's really problematic, is it pulls it out of context because they see it as a matter of something different than than other kinds of questions of intimacy. That may itself be a mistake.
Right.
because sex became a commodity, basically.
Exactly. Once you allow for that possibility that sex becomes a commodity or something to be exchanged for something that you want, or it's somehow a special realm of human beings that has nothing to do with other things that people are doing. So when second graders or first graders are learning how to share things or to put things back or how to relate to people's feelings when they hurt them, they're doing exactly the same kind of thing as they will eventually do that will have to do with the human body. If they learn to close a bathroom door out of respect for privacy, they're learning many of the same things that they will have to later on use when they're adults in marriage with respect to privacy about the physical body of their partner. So I don't like the idea of pulling it out and seeing it as somewhere or other a technical area that requires its own expertise different from the psychology of all questions of intimacy, love, and connection.
I agree. I'm wondering who's going to do the teaching here. In other words, will this require a new special set of educating techniques where you're teaching the teachers or the rabbis or the people who are doing this to be trained how to do this? Because your ordinary school teacher, I count myself among them, does not receive necessarily training in how to do this kind of thing.
Yeah, 100%. So when we piloted the curriculum at SAR and Yeshivat Noam and several more schools have taken it on this year, the curriculum authors came in and did a two-day teacher training, which, again, 2 days is not necessarily enough, right, but given everything, that was all we were able to do. We felt very strongly, and this, I guess, connects with something that Rabbi Blanchard mentioned, is that teachers from the school, you know, the Chumash teacher, the Navi teacher, are the people who should be teaching this curriculum. Because when you bring in an outside expert, you know, the doctor, the pediatrician who comes in to give this lecture, it reinforces the idea that this is something that's not part of daily life. When you have your teacher teaching it, this is something that everyone experiences as a human being, and it becomes more integrated, which is very important.
I mean, I have to, in the interest of full disclosure, I got to tell you that my experience as a high school principal in this area showed me that there's a certain double bind here. On the one hand, it needs to be talked about and talked about very importantly. On the other hand, the community is very nervous about talking about it. This is not an area, especially among observant Jews, that people are themselves necessarily very comfortable with. And they're wondering, what are you saying to their kids? How are you operating? What's going on? So I completely share this view that normalizing it by bringing it in is the way to go. But it has to be done very carefully, because otherwise what happens is parents go off the wall and start making phone calls, and it becomes unpleasant, and one needs to know how to do this. So some people are very skilled at making it happen, and other schools it's harder. It takes a lot more work. That's all.
Just going to change tacks briefly and move it forward. Obviously, sexuality just one part of the whole issue of Jewish dating, and there's a lot of media talk in Jewish media for the last number of years about something that they call the shidduch crisis or the singles crisis. I'm wondering, is it an accurate phrase? I'm always nervous when people use the word crisis. I think of Darfur as a crisis. I don't think of this as a crisis. What does it really mean when we say this? And what do you see as some of the key issues or problems in the present system, dating system, that are confronting people who want to find a partner?
Yeah, my sense is about why the word crisis is used is that I think it reflects our sensibility of living in a fast food culture where we microwave our foods, we expect immediate results, and it's not the same patience anymore for things that cook on a slower burner and that need more time to simmer. And that same sense of immediacy and the need for immediate results is reflected in the dating, in the shidduch situation, where people tend to feel there's like a arbitrary kind of protocol of, say, a 3-month period of time or a 10-week period of time during which one should have the answer of whether or not you want to proceed. And there's a sense of this one-size-fits-all mentality that the community has adopted that I think is hurting us as a community, because obviously not everybody can conform to the one-size-fits-all model, and people with different temperaments need different types of situations that will bring them out. So I think the sense of the crisis mode that people describe having, I think, is reflective of the fact that we have this sense of immediacy of needing to have answers, needing to get through this very quickly. And among the young, just in relation to the first topic, among the young women, young men and women that I see in my practice on the Upper West Side, my sense is that most of the women particularly are eager, like in their 21, 22, are eager to, you know, they graduate from college, they have, you know, aspirations of going to medical school, law school, graduate school, and there's a sense of wanting to get married so they can get that realm of their life taken care of so they can go on with their career goals and then have baby number one or two or three before they're 30. And there's a sense that we live in a very driven community. We're most of us are very high achieving and wanting to accomplish a lot. And there's a sense of immediacy of having to do it all before they're unable to have as many children as they might want to have. So that's part of the sense of immediacy. I think that the young women particularly feel very, very compelled to get this over with and get the marriage piece over with so they can go on with their life and continue achieving what they want to achieve. And that often that arbitrary kind of clock that looms large becomes a sense of pressure that is often unhelpful.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think you said pretty much all that I have in my mind. Except that, I mean, I have a small number of people that I still see. A high percentage of them are people in their, I'd say, somewhere between, say, 31, 32, and 40. All of them in the middle of their own personal shidduch crisis in their minds. No matter how many times I point out to them that I've seen probably 50 people pass through my office like this, all of whom ended up married, okay? They don't experience it that way. So there are two different senses of crisis. One is the way in which people talk about it as a social phenomenon. And there I really understand what Naomi's talking about. But there's also that personal experience of terror that comes to people who don't feel like they're walking through charted territory. They belong to a culture whose ways of meeting people are somewhat limited for them. They've passed the automatic age. They don't think it's happening. And the truth is that they're not in that situation, but it feels for all the world to them like, how is this ever going to, where's the light at the end of this tunnel? And there probably needs to be a good deal more effort putting into making it clear that there is a path to continue going on and that people aren't out of the game because, say, they're 32 years old or 35 years old and some of them are not yet married.
Or that there are multiple paths.
Right, there are multiple paths. You're right, not one size does not fit all.
But I think that the crisis is also beyond just marriage. In other words, the crisis isn't about the fact that we have hundreds or thousands of people who are above age X who aren't married. I think that the crisis is more about, I guess just from where I'm seeing it, it's more about people not having the tools or not knowing what path or what multiple paths lay ahead of them. People who feel like they're desperate to get married, but yet they can't get past a first date. So I think that the crisis is more in that individual existential level, right, not knowing how to navigate the terrain.
Those are the people, what you just mentioned, are the people that I see. People who say, I've dated 35 people in the last, you know, umpteen months. I can't get past date one or two. What's happening? What's going
right.
on?
And it's also people who, unfortunately, you don't see, who are sticking right. with it and
right.
who won't even
right.
walk into the therapist's office.
But I think part of what creates that sense of crisis or that problem is that I think if we look around this room, most of us who are over 40, I think most of us would admit that we met our spouses in more casual or more natural ways, not necessarily on blind dates. Is that true for many of you? Right? And recently there was a meeting at the OU about this shidduch crisis issue, and they went around the room, and almost all the rabbis that were in the room admitted they had met their wife either at a wedding or at a Bnei Akiva or through NCSY or at a dance or they're all different ways. Not one of them had met through a shidduch. So I think this new model that the community has adopted of the shidduch, of the blind date model, is really a new one. And it seems like it's an experiment that I'm not sure is working as well for everybody. It might work very well for some, but it's certainly not working for everybody. So I think those people who are not getting past the first date, one of the questions I would ask is, you know, are they exploring multiple options? You know, are there multiple options that they feel that are there for them?
Which there aren't often, or which they don't feel right. they have.
Why aren't there multiple options? What's happened here? In other words, why are you saying that they can't get past date one because, in a way, there wasn't enough? Date one really wasn't a natural encounter, or it was a long shot proposition in the first place.
Well, you know, people have different temperaments. Somebody who is more extroverted, not everybody's a good speed dater. Some people are good at marketing themselves and putting themselves forward and might interview very well for jobs, but are not necessarily the best worker, right? So not everybody presents themselves as well on a first date in that kind of way. They're not as comfortable, you know, showcasing all their strengths, and not all their strengths might not get showcased in the context of a date like that. They might do better if getting to know somebody over time, or somebody who might be more reserved or might be slower to trust or slower to attach, or might need a context in which to get to know somebody differently, so like on a shul committee or through the natural flow of being in a community with somebody. There are many people who do better in those kind of situations.
Yeah, let me tell you a story. I was teaching at Drisha, an institute for women, and one day one of my students came in and she said, "I get a mazel tov, I'm engaged." So I said, "Mazel tov, do I know the guy?" So she gave me his name, and I said, "That's funny. I thought you went out with him like about 8-9 months ago. You told me it didn't work out." She said, "Yeah, well, it was like this. When we were fixed up, we went on a date. So when you go on a first date, you put on your mask." So I had my mask on, and he had his mask on. My mask did not like his mask, and his mask did not like my mask. So we didn't continue the date. But it turned out we were on a shul committee together. But when you're on a shul committee, you don't have to wear your mask. So I met him, and I turned out to like him, and he turned out to like me. So there's a certain way in which if you put people in situations that are, I wouldn't say unnatural, but let's put their what I call mask, situations that call for masking identity and presenting yourself in a very limited way, you cut down the extent to which somebody can actually be known and discovered, and it's problematic. I'm not saying that explains everybody's situation. What I'm saying is it does create a difficulty for a culture in which people can't meet each other as people. They have to meet each other as dating masks. That's a problematic. It'd be like going out on a job interview. Every time you want a date, I mean, there are people who date as if it's a job interview. They show up, have a list of things that you're required to do. Are you with this? Are you with that? Are you with this? Are you that? You feel like saying, "Where's the W-2 that I'm going to get at the end of this meeting?" Okay, that also doesn't help very much. Okay, I don't know who you are. I know, you know, what your parents, where you go to school, what kind of shoes you wear. This doesn't help either, because it creates a picture of a person which is so skewed that it really isn't terribly attractive once you've, you know, really got, because her mask didn't like his mask, his didn't like, but you don't marry a mask, you marry a person.
I want to follow up on the issue of the time pressure. I agree with you. It is unnatural to be able to condense relationships, which do have to evolve, and I like the word simmer. And yet, I hear from a lot of people, and there seems to be quite a bit of research on this now, that there does seem to be a gender issue and an age issue. That's real. In other words, you know, age is obviously a very sensitive issue in all communities, and especially in the Orthodox community, and it's increasingly in all communities, not just the observant communities. Men are not as open to dating women their own age, never mind a woman who is older than them. And so if you're a 35-year-old man and you're a 35-year-old woman, it doesn't seem like there's a level playing field going on. I guess what I'm asking is, do women now have the sense when they're younger that this is what's going on, and therefore I sort of have to, you know, get on the train and get moving out of the station, because if I wait too long, it's going to embark without me, sort of thing. Has it created a kind of unnatural set of expectations?
Well, I think that also speaks to the same issue of this one model of the blind date. Because if the shidduch date is the only protocol that we're following, then that might invite that kind of thinking about whose presentation has a higher market value, or whose resume has a higher market value than the next person's. But if we're talking about meeting people in a different context where you're getting to know the whole person, if somebody's on a shul committee, or if somebody's in a class, or in a seminar, or in a learning situation, or in a youth group with somebody, and you meet the person and you get to see their strengths in lots of different contexts and see who they are in many ways, then the age doesn't become as much as a fact. In my experience, I don't think the age has been as important as it is when you're looking at somebody's resume and you're looking at somebody in a kind of an objective way, like as on a blind date.
Well, I mean, there are... I wish I could give a different answer to this question than I'm going to give. Think about height for a minute. Is a 6'2" woman and a 6'2" man, are they on a level playing field when they go out on a date? Okay, yes and no. A 6'2" man has a large number of shorter women he can date, but it's very unlikely that a 6'2" woman would find lots of men at 5'8" dating her. It's just a matter of fact. So in one sense, there has to be a truth in what you're saying, meaning that society is not an equal playing field around those issues completely. The question is, how important is that difference? It's not really exactly a playing field. This is not an investment house. The issue that a person who's, say, 33-year-old woman thinking to herself, do I have the same opportunities as a man? Is that the question, or is the question, do I have enough opportunities to attain what I want to attain in my life? There's always something that puts you at a disadvantage vis-a-vis somebody else. The real question about life is not, am I better or worse off than somebody else? Is can I achieve the kind of things that are important to a human being to achieve? Can I find someone who will love me and I will love them? Somebody I would trust to build a family with? Someone I would rely on? If the answers to those questions are yes, who cares that there were thousands of men who wouldn't have taken me out? Or thousands of... Take a guy who makes his living, I don't know, in the United States. If a guy makes his living, say, as a high school teacher, there are lots of women who won't give him 5 minutes. As far as they're concerned, that's not enough of an income. Is he a disadvantage compared to a guy who makes $300,000 a year? Yes, he is. Okay, but his question isn't whether or not every woman will go out with me. It's, will somebody appreciate me, care about me, and want to marry me? And the answer to that invariably is yes, whatever he does, even if he does that for a living. So someone, I said, here's this woman, I meet all kinds of women, 38 years old, she's telling me it's over, life is finished, there are no men are interested in her, she's done, she can never have enough kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, married with 3 children. What happened? Who cared about all the men that didn't go out with her? Who gives a hoot about the... I could find 10,000 guys who'd say I'd never date a 38-year-old woman. Who cares? She wanted the one guy she could marry, and that's what she needed to find. So it's not a question of a playing field. It's a question of, is it possible for me to find somebody? And the answer invariably to that is not 100%, but the answer is typically yes. Most people do find somebody. It isn't a pleasant trip. That's a different question.
Yeah. Also, I'd like to add one more thing. Sorry. Is that I think it also depends on, you know, at any point, the woman in that situation, say the hypothetical 33-year-old woman, yeah, let's say, She might also say, okay, if a 28-year-old guy doesn't want to go out with her, then that's fine. But then there are still men in their 30s or early 40s, some of whom might be divorced or widowed or who knows what. There are always people coming and going in the community. Like people say, well, they've missed the boat, but there are multiple boats coming and going all the time. And as long as somebody's flexible enough to kind of shift their framework, perhaps, and say, okay, so let's say. Say it's the 28-year-old won't want my mommy, but there'll be a 37-year-old who might show up from a different community who might be available. So I think it depends on how flexible we are in thinking about, you know, who's possible, or a bal tshuva, or there are multiple ways to think about this that sometimes can expand your possibilities.
Look, I mean, I hear what you're saying about expanding the horizon, right, but at the same time, I hear something different when you're saying a 30-year-old woman should, you know, be open to marrying a divorcee, a widower, you know, a man who's 50.
I didn't say 50.
Oh, no, that's right. You didn't say 50. I'm exaggerating. But I guess maybe we could think about it, and I don't know what the answer to this is there something wrong with our value system if, you know, men in their 30s feel like they can say that they won't date anyone above 25. And then there are all the women in their 30s who are contemporaries of these men who can't get a date, and that can become a problem.
My answer to your question would be yes, there is, but not for the same reason. If a 33-year-old guy is in my office bemoaning the fact that he can't get 23-year-old women to go out with him, I always ask him, do you want to go out with 23-year-old women whose life experience is so fundamentally different? What would you find attractive about someone in that situation, given where you are in your life and the things that you've seen? Most of it's true, they're sort of putting up with 23-year-olds because they're thinking to themselves, that's why I should be dating. The problem is, it's unreal. It's not just a question of who's available, it's where's the match between somebody who's built a business, a career, is in his mid-30s, settled down, has all kinds of experiences, and someone who's in her second year of medical school.
Or college.
Where's the match on that? That has nothing to do with age. It has to do with where they're at in their lives. And that seems to me to be a fundamental problem of... And what I'm trying to get at, there's no question. The community, there are going to be demographics. But it doesn't look as if, at the end of the day, the demographics destroy the possibilities for people's happiness.
Because you're speaking rationally, and much of this has to do with the irrational. So I'll tell you a story, okay? This is going back some years now. I had a female student who went to see the movie Titanic 14 times in 30 days. 14 times in 30 days. So she said to me afterwards, she said, I want a love just like that. And I said, you want your partner to die in the Atlantic Ocean? She said, no, I want that kind of exciting, I'm paraphrasing, I'm trying to remember what she said, but exciting, totally consumed by the other person love, where the person is absolutely the right one, and you feel it in every bone of your body. So what do we think of that? In other words, are we going for that kind of love? When you say the 33-year-old is looking at the 23-year-old, is he looking at her because he thinks that's what he can get, because he's trying to bank off of a visceral sexual attraction and hoping that the rest of the elements fall in so he can get that kind of, you know, a Titanic kind of love, and he thinks if he marries somebody older that he won't get that kind of love? No, it's because something is going on here. This is not an accident.
I'm not a disinterested observer on this question, because I used to appear regularly on Fox TV, and then I trashed the movie Titanic for presenting the image of a person whose great moment was a guy who died in the Atlantic Ocean. And I asked, what do you think her husband and children are thinking about as they watch this movie and realize that she was unwilling to love anybody after this Jack dies in the Atlantic? She lived with all these people, and she marries, she gets settled, she has it all, and it gets written off. So that at the end she goes off in this dream sequence, or this post-death sequence. There's something fundamentally wrong, in my view, with people who are thinking to themselves that love is about this mantis-like, immediately consumpting experience in which you find this person, it's unbelievable, and it can never be the same. Yeah, she'd married Jack, she'd have fought over who's going to change the diapers, and we need more money to pay the bills, she'd have had the same life that everybody else has. If you're on the Titanic and it's going down, and you're about to sink and you're sacrificing everything for the other person, you can have that experience. If you want to live a real life, you're going to have a very different kind of experience. Mm-hmm. So I think you get caught up in that image, you're a dead duck.
Right. Just to expand on that, there was a famous study done on the trajectory of most relationships, and they found that most romantic relationships begin, for the most part, with an infatuation period where you meet the person and, like, you're starry-eyed and they're starry-eyed, and the person is flawless, they can do no wrong, and it's that kind of description of the romantic, you know, epiphany. But that lasts for a certain period of time, and for each relationship it might last for a different period. But at some point they come to a point where they're maybe their first fight, or at some point they kind of come to a realization that the person is not flawless. They are human. They have issues, and they begin to they come off the pedestal, and they come to a fork in the road. At that point, at that fork in the road, they either break up. Often people break up at that point, or they stay. If they stay, the love changes. It deepens. It's no longer this kind of infatuated love, but it's a deeper kind of love where you decide, I'm going to stay with this person despite their flaws, despite their issues, but I want to stay because there's something that makes it worthwhile to stay. So the study showed that couples who marry after that fork in the road period, in other words, people who marry once the person has fallen off the pedestal, have a much better prognosis, better chance of long-term success in marriage than those who marry during the period of infatuation and then when that fork in the road happens after marriage. So in other words, when people wake up after marriage realizing, oh, the person is not what I thought they were, there's more information here than what I knew before, that's a harder experience to have, and it's a harder prognosis for the long-term success of the marriage. So the sense is that whether or not anyone, having that kind of romantic love is, for some people who are capable of it, that's terrific, as long as they marry with their eyes wide open, not in that state of druggy kind of high where the person is can do no wrong.
Yeah, I agree, and I actually have a friend who might have beaten your student in terms of watching Titanic. I think it was 10 times in 2 weeks. And today is still not married. And I don't think that that's completely by accident. I think that the unrealistic expectations that people get about love and marriage from the media, from movies, it impacts them and it stays with them. And oftentimes the Jewish community isn't there to give them any other message. We don't have a message about what marriage should be. And so people have that starry-eyed vision, whether it's Titanic or any other number of movies. And when, you know, date number three doesn't live up to it, that's it. And they kind of, you know, enter the cycle of dating.
I'm telling the story with my wife's permission. I mean, I won't deny that we had the infatuation period that did exist. Wildly so, and then we got down to talking about getting married. So, you know, these interminable discussions of should we get married or not getting married, you have these cockeyed, crazy conversations in which you list what it is that's missing in the other person, that you don't like about the other person, why you're not just marrying them. So we're in the middle of one of those conversations. Okay, and I'm listing, I mean, I look back, I think how foolish I was, but it seemed real at the time. I'm listing, you know, this is a problem, this is a problem, this is a hassle. So she stops me, she says, just a minute. If you marry me, you will definitely have hassles. You don't have to marry me. But if you do, I guarantee you, I will come with my hassles. Everybody comes with hassles. Don't compare me in your mind, though, to some imaginary woman that you could marry who has no hassles. If you marry somebody else, she will have a different set of hassles that you'll come with. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me that is the truth. Everybody comes with a set of demands, with a set of hassles, with who they are. We can always in our head sort of imagine, okay, this person who would be just exactly the person we type into the computer and print out, okay, who would meet our narcissistic specifications. But there are no such people in the actual real world. Everybody you marry, okay, will not be exactly the person you imagine you want to have. Of course, the minute she said that, I realized she's a genius. I should marry her immediately, which is what I did.
Something that I just want to follow up with. There's a balance that I think I find confusing. I think a lot of people find confusing. It comes between the lines of what you're all saying. So here we are up on this panel, and we're making this case, I think correctly. You know, we're making the sober, mature, rational case. Everybody comes with their stuff, and you've got to know that. And you don't marry fantasy people, and that's all true. On the other hand, we have this kind of caricature, Titanic, romantic love. And I guess what everybody wants to know is where's the balance, right? Because it is a little, I have to say personally, a little tiresome for me to hear endless divrei Torah about this week's Parsha, you know, last week's Parsha, Chayei Sarah, where, you know, it says that Yitzhak married Rivka and then he loved her. And so you see you get married and then love comes afterwards. And in a way, I have to say, like, gag me with a spoon. Like, enough. You know, there has to be a feeling of it, because you're not just marrying, you know, your coworker in the next cubicle and hoping that love sprouts 10 years later. So there is obviously some kind of balance between really wanting to feel a kinetic connection and yet realizing that there are going to be problems. And I think actually for people who date, this is a very tough one because they don't know how to figure out the balance. How much do I need of each, etc. You know what I'm asking you. So how do we negotiate this?
I have two things to say about that. One is, before I answer the balance question, there are two ways that people, based on my experience in the research that I've seen, there are two ways that people push our buttons. Some of them are unhealthy ways. In other words, we tend to revert back often to situations in which what's attractive about the other person is not always the best for us. People with masochistic needs being attracted to very strong, controlling partners. People with strong needs to control and dominate a partner being attracted to submissive individuals. People who have low self-esteem being attracted to people who will support them in the end. Okay, there are all kinds of reasons that aren't that behind what we call chemistry, which aren't helpful reasons. Okay, and I've had more than one patient that I've seen over the years who didn't really get started dating until they got rid of the fact that they were always attracted to people who really weren't long-term good for them. Now back to the balancing question. You're certainly right. Marrying somebody that you don't find yourself sizzled by is probably sizzled too strong. Marrying somebody you don't think to yourself, wow, sometimes, is probably a big mistake. Even with all the hassles, because what gets you through the hassles is the understanding of what a great person you married. Can I tell the other story? The angry story.
Yeah.
Okay. We're having this fight in the middle of the living room. One of these fights that you don't like to admit you have. You know, the yelling and screaming and being really out of control, yelling at each other. And all of a sudden, every time I'm making what I think are great points, and she's answering every one of them back. And all of a sudden I realized, wow, I stopped and I thought, wow, what a woman I am married to. So I said, you know what? I'd rather fight with you than get along with somebody else. You can have it. This one, you win. You have it any way you like. But, you know, that ability to say, you know, this is a person. This is really somebody. You think to yourself, I'm the luckiest person in the world to be able even to fight with a person like this. This is terrific. You need that, too, because that's what gets us through the hassles, the sense of, wow, do I want to be with you? Anyway, I think that worked for me and the people that I know.
The analogy that I often give, that often comes up when I discuss this with patients, is what the patients often come up with, is that it's sort of like with Judaism, that, you know, all of us who are practicing Jews, we don't often feel the same kind of kavanah or excitement about Judaism or davening or whatever practices we're doing. We don't always feel the same kind of excitement. Often we do it by rote, but every once in a while, we do have those moments of that high, the spiritual moment where we realize, wow, it's all coming together. And for those moments, it all feels worth it. So this is similar to what you said before.
I want to talk a little bit about non-Orthodox dating, because most of the people I teach are not necessarily observant Jews, and it's really a big distortion to say that problems with romance are only taking place inside of the Orthodox community. There's really a large question that's hanging over the entire Jewish community. And problems in Jewish dating are doubtless connected to the heavy increase in intermarriage in the Jewish community. Bottom line is that many Jews presently do not see it as a priority to marry other Jews. That's not an anecdote. That's stone cold fact. Many Jews do not see it as a priority to marry other Jews. And the truth is that studies have shown that the alienation is heavier on the male side. So put a different way, many Jewish men no longer see it as a priority to marry Jewish women. We know this now. We know this in dizzyingly tragic statistical studies. And you have a perfect storm of sorts that's going on where, in fact, as many Jewish men do not see it as desirable to marry Jewish women, many non-Jewish women see it as desirable to marry Jewish men. So you have this perfect storm going on, and this is already culturally, we've seen this going back with, you know, Arthur Miller marries Marilyn Monroe, and Philip Roth has all of his characters fantasizing about sleeping with what he calls shiksas. The lure of the non-Jewish woman is basically an ever-present fact in modern Jewish life. And the admiration obviously seems to be mutual. In the meantime, the loss to the Jewish people is incalculable. So I'm wondering, what do you think is going on specifically with Jewish men? And what do you think can be done on just a basic level to re-encourage Jewish men and women to reinvest in one another?
In defense of Jewish women, I used to lead an interfaith couples group at the 92nd Street Y, which consisted of couples that were dating very seriously towards marriage, some of whom were engaged, they would commit to this group for about a 12-week period of time. But I would have to say that there were the half the group were Jewish women and non-Jewish men. So I think the paradigm is changing. I think the Philip Roth examples and from I.B. Singer and from Arthur Miller, that was a generation ago or two generations ago. I think Jewish women now are very, unfortunately, perhaps, but from a gender perspective, fortunately, they're just as comfortable dating outside the faith as men are.
But I'm wondering if that's a priori. In other words, is it that they a priori want to date non-Jewish men, or is there a certain thing going on where they sort of see, like, Jewish men are not interesting to me, they kind of wait around, and then they sort of cut bait and say, you know what, I just want to be with someone.
No, I'm not sure.
You don't know.
That's not been my observation in the group, but...
Okay.
I don't necessarily think so. I think what it could be about, and this kind of goes along with what you were saying, is that today when men and women are more equally in the workforce and exposed to non-Jewish potential people, that can become kind of level the playing field. And I think what that points to is, you know, we were talking earlier about the ways that we meet people, and when you work with someone day in, day out, you get to see them in a natural state. You get to joke around, you get to see them on their good days, on their bad days, and people don't have that opportunity with other Jews. And so they're meeting non-Jews in this casual way. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that kind of has more weight for them than this resume that they get sent for the, you know, next week's blind date. And I think that maybe that's the problem. And maybe if we start creating more ways for Jews to meet other Jews, then that could help the situation.
Excellent point. See, I have to say, I think I don't completely agree with the three of you, because I know from the students I teach that there are perceptions that men are developing about Jewish women. I know this from my college students, and I know this from my high school students. There are negative, sort of almost Pavlovian negative adjectives that get applied, like materialistic, Jappy. Like shallow, like jappy, etc. And this has been for a few generations. And I don't think it's, in other words, I'm not negating what you're saying. Clearly, you know, opportunities to meet and so forth are important. But there is something going on in the psyche of Jewish guys.
Well, I think it's similar to what goes on in the black community, too, because I think most communities who are oppressed or who experience themselves as the subject of bias internalize a sense of self-hate. And the women who are like, the women who are on the lower sphere of every system are from the ones onto whom those negative stereotypes are put. So in other words, if the stereotype that Jews has always been materialistic, pushy, all of those, cheap, whatever, so then Jewish men incorporate those ideas and they shift them onto the Jewish woman, and then and as a way of coping with their own kind of sense of their own struggles with who they are as Jewish men. So, I mean, I suppose that is there, but my sense is that the other struggles come up when they're with the non-Jewish women, like in the group, for example. The Jewish men would come in often with a very shallow sense of their own spirituality and disinterest in spirituality, actually, just an ethnic sensibility about having been, about being Jews. And yet they come in with these non-Jewish women who are very sincere and very eager, and they start learning about spirituality and they start incorporating Jewish practices. And all of a sudden, the Jewish men have to confront, well, what does this mean to me to be Jewish? So often people, look for a spouse or look for somebody in the couple onto whom that person can kind of take on that which they're ambivalent about.
So actually the non-Jewish partner forcing them to think about who am I as a Jew. Right.
We might be also seeing a phenomenon in which Jewish or ethnic identity crosses over to class issues. Like the Real Housewives of Atlanta, okay, has no Jewish women on it, but you can't get a more materialist, self-seeking group of women in your life than are playing on that show. The same is true of The Housewives of Orange County. Remember, these are very popular TV shows in the United States of America. That's a class phenomenon. And it's possible if you push all Jews into the upper middle class and the wealthy, that the expectations that people coming out of that class have are characterized by a certain amount of materialism and expectations about success measured in materialist criteria. So you may be seeing an overlap in that way. Also, in the Revel and Prell, the sociologist, cultural anthropologist at Minnesota, did a study of the Yiddish letters in the Bintel brief.
So you're dealing here with the early 20th century and maybe certainly first quarter of the 20th century. There's a lot of complaining there about Jewish men about Jewish women and Jewish women about Jewish men. The Jewish men are complaining that their wives are materialistic and they want to keep buying things and spend a lot of money. And the women are complaining that the husbands don't care about them and want to give them what they need. And her explanation was that Jewish men were in the process of building up businesses to get into America. And businesses requires recycling a lot of the money you have back into the business to enlarge it. So they didn't want to spend on consumer goods. Whereas Jewish women, in order to show that they were successful in America, had to what? Had to buy things to show that they were successful. And that put them at odds. It had nothing to do with being Jewish. It had to do with where you were in the American socioeconomic spot. So you may be seeing some of that, too, especially since I can show you plenty of examples of non-Jewish women on TV who live out the, quote, Jap stereotype completely. I'm not sure it's Jewish or non-Jewish. It may have to do with upper middle class and wealthy as the issue.
I'm going to be asking a couple more questions. Can I just see, do people want to ask questions from the floor? You will? Okay. So people always complain there's not enough time for questions. So I'm going to leave a lot of time this evening for questions from the floor. I'm just going to take this one further and talk about what happens when they do intermarry. The following remarks were made last year in a major American newspaper, in the New York Times. Quote, despite my intimate understanding of the mindset that requires such careful attention to who is in and who is out, I am still taken by surprise each time I am confronted by my old school's inability to treat me like any other graduate. I have tried in my own imperfect way to live up to the values that the school taught me, expressing my respect and love for the wisdom of the tradition while trying to reconcile Jewish faith with scholarship and engagement in the public sphere. As a result, I have not felt myself to have rejected my upbringing, even when some others imagined me to have done so by virtue of my marriage. The author of these words is a man named Dr. Noah Feldman. And the piece in which they were written was called Orthodox Paradox, which was published in the New York Times Sunday Magazine in July of 2007. Noah Feldman is a professor at Harvard Law School who was educated in a modern Orthodox school in Boston, the Maimonides School. He went on to intermarry with a Korean woman. And the article is highly condemnatory of the school's rejection of him after he intermarried and obviously dropped religious observance. And my interest in raising this is not to debate the relative merits of his piece, but rather to ask something that comes up a lot, which is how should non-Jewish partners be treated in the Jewish community?
Well, just anecdotally, just in my experience, it seems like in this generation things are really changing, that in terms of the group, the women that I've worked, the couples that I've worked with, often it seems that the non-Jewish partner is becoming increasingly interested in Judaism and is interested in studying and learning. So I think we're seeing a different field than we used to.
You see that as a positive, I'm taking it.
Well, that the story is not over. Even if they marry a non-Jew, we have to figure out exactly what our relationship will be to them and how our institutions are going to handle them. But just to keep in mind that the story is not over, because often people will convert later on to the marriage, or they'll raise their children as Jewish, and we continue to have a relationship with Judaism. So it's complicated.
So you see it as important to keep the door open for that possibility.
On some level.
As opposed to, we hear stories of the older situation, rejection, possibly sitting Shiva, et cetera. You see that as a paradigm that should no longer be employed?
Sitting Shiva, I don't know.
It's probably mythical, but, there are stories where people did sit. I'd be interested. I've not actually been able to find a source for this. But sociologically, we know that people did at some point. So, but it's just reflective of the idea of complete rejection, right? So the person's dead, right? So you would not advocate for that kind of stance,
right? Because as long as people are connected, there's still potential for change.
I see.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think taking it apart from the Feldman affair itself, which had its own,
right,
complications, I think I agree with what you're saying in terms of keeping the door open, because it's ironic that oftentimes it will be the non-Jewish partner who will end up you know, drawing the Jewish person back in, or sometimes even becoming Jewish themselves and rejecting the Jewish person because they're not into Judaism enough. So I think that having an open door can be a good idea.
You? No. Okay. Okay, so I'm going to ask one last question, and after that, we're going to throw it open to the audience. I'm wondering if there's something about Orthodox Judaism itself that may contribute to difficulties in romantic negotiation. What I mean is that you're talking about sometimes a very head-oriented, kind of intellectualized religion, a lot of minutiae, a lot of details. You don't see many young people growing up, unless they had really good models in parents and the home, learning about the world of emotions, especially boys, you know, training them in that kind of the emotional skills, I guess, to carry out in an intimate relationship. If you spend many years in yeshiva, do you learn that kind of emotional skill? So I'm wondering if you could comment on that.
Orthodoxy, am I recording? Can you hear me? Orthodoxy or not, I don't think men get very good education. I don't know if training is the right word. Education in America in general, in North America in general. You'll have to tell me about Canada better than... In the States, men don't do very well learning how to deal with emotions well. Adolescent male culture is not aimed at learning to do those things. And while there are, you get a certain number of points for appearing as a kind of sensitive, caring male, okay, you don't get any points with your boyfriends about that. You don't get any real points among your young. You don't get any points on an athletic situation. You don't get too many points when you're hanging out with your friends. The reality is that you don't get status, get to be cool in any way because you handle your emotions well. You actually do better if you appear to be somebody who can blow off emotions in a serious way. Now, that's not a universally true, but it's true enough to constitute an important half-truth. So it's not just Jewish. It's a pale issue that's been taken up now for over 35 years. What are you going to do about, you know, helping men cope with these kinds of things? That said, there's nothing about practicing Judaism in itself that automatically makes it a head religion. But it is true that modern Orthodoxy, among the various ways of expressing Torah, tends to stress... The same way the yeshiva shevelt, which I'm more familiar with, tends to stress success at expressing things in intellectualized ways. And it is true that if you observe, I mean, go back to old yeshivas I attended, you watch guys walking down the street and they look like sort of a head attached loosely to a body they're dragging along with it. And there is a sense in which that is true. I'm not going to deny that that's true. And we have found very few ways of actually getting the human body back into the world of the experience of the person. It's too bad, because the real depth in religious experience and God consciousness and the ability to daven well comes from this ability to integrate, you know, with the expression is kal atzmotai tamarna. All of my bones, my entire body has to capture it. There's lots of great Hasidic material on doing this. And we haven't done a real good job of integrating that. I think you've got an excellent point. I wish I knew what the answer was.
I just wanted to bring up something. I don't know if it made it to this side of the ocean, but in Israel, I recently heard about a case that was making the news about a young Haredi man who killed his son. I think it was a 3-month-old infant by shaking him. And it was a story in all the newspapers and the question, should he be acquitted? The community was standing behind him. So one thing I actually read in an article that someone sent me was that the court in the end did exercise leniency in terms of his sentence. And what they said was as follows. This is a quote from, I guess, the court decision. We have to consider that this is a young man who has never before been given any responsibilities besides learning the Torah. It is the court's belief that he did not intend to kill his son and that his actions stemmed from recklessness. So I thought that was just very interesting, because it really points to exactly the issue that you're bringing up, which is that people aren't being given the tools to deal with life's experiences that kind of that will face them. And that's something that I think we definitely need to take to heart. And the first thing I thought about when hearing about this case is just how important that type of education is, because anyone who's dealt with a newborn baby knows that it's challenging, and you need preparation and education. So.
Okay. If you could give these speakers a hand. We're going to take questions from the floor now. We just ask you to step up to the mic at the front. And when you ask your question, please direct it to the person whom you want to answer it. I'm saying this because I had a show of about six hands before. I hope they haven't all disappeared.
You may not want to come to the front of the mic.
That's all right. They can walk.
Sorry I was late, so if you had addressed this earlier, I apologize. I have two different questions. One is, you were talking about the education about sexuality in schools. How do you pair that with SMEUT? Like, I could never imagine my own children's teachers talking about their sexuality. It's a private matter, and that's part of their stance, is that it is private. So how do you deal with these topics? I even dealt with that in grade three. Kids were very upset that certain kids knew about sexuality and their parents were mad that it was being talked about. It wasn't SNEAS. So there's that issue. And on a very different way, in the from world, where I feel that boys are trained to look a certain way, that they're learners. They shouldn't be taking time to learn a musical instrument or follow a completely different instrument. They're learners, because the girls are also being trained that they want to marry a learner, even though they have no idea what that actually means or what that's going to mean in their relationship with them. And then they do get married, the from girl marries the learner, they have children already, 5 years, they've got three children, they're dealing with their children, he's learning. I'm wondering, and we know in 18 years these kids are already going to be marrying off their children, where is there a place to be building a much deeper relationship, and the relationship almost becomes a function of supporting the learning and that whole culture. So I just wanted to address those issues.
Okay, so to take issue number one in terms of the SMEUT in sexual education. So one thing I would say is that what's important about having a curriculum that teachers can use is that it's not personal. In other words, it's not the teacher bringing their own experiences into the classroom and bringing that out, because I think that a lot of times that would be a violation of SMEUT and also just boundaries between teacher-student. But in terms of the broader question of how can talking about issues of sexuality be tsanua, even if, you know, you're not talking about your own personal experiences, just teaching about that whole realm, I think that it can be done with a sense of SMEUT. I think it's important to clarify that SMEUT isn't about, you know, leaving kids in ignorance and leaving them unable to cope with life's realities of marriage that and intimacy that they're going to have to face. And, you know, I'm not a therapist, so I haven't seen this in clinical practice, but I've heard just anecdotally and the work that I've done in the community about cases of unconsummated marriages and sexual dysfunctions, many of which could have been prevented by education. And a lot of times, you know, what an hour or two of education could have done before marriage, once you have people living with an unconsummated marriage for 10 years, it's no longer about, you know, a couple of hours of education. So I think that putting sexual education in the framework of trying to prepare kids for marriage and to be able to build a family, a bayis ne'eman b'Yisrael, and seeing the function of sexual education through that prism, and doing it in an appropriate context in the school can perhaps address that.
I just want to add amen to that. I mean, I have clinically seen a number of, more than one case by a long shot, of people who simply didn't, they could have used one day of sexual, and it really, they didn't go for 10 years unconsummated, but they certainly had significant sexual dysfunction. Could easily have been eliminated with appropriate previous things. So amen to what you just said. This learner thing's a little hard. On the one hand, we want a very highly educated Jewish populace to the extent that we can have it. And we're investing a lot of money and time in Jewish schools and teaching
both young men and young women how to study and what to study, and trying to produce a seriously educated group of Jews. And so in one sense, it's very important that people think of their having a lifelong commitment to Jewish study and learning. On the other hand, sometimes when people say, well, it's want to marry a learner, in quotes, that has nothing to do with real learning. It may have to do with a certain kind of status. I came through the Lakewood system. My old alma mater put in a rule that said you couldn't start dating till you were 6 months in the yeshiva, because people were just signing up to be able to say that they went there so they could get a shidduch. That's not a learner. That wasn't somebody who was committed to ongoing learning and wanted to make sure that the person he married understood that he needed times to do that in a serious way. So when it becomes a cultural phenomenon rather than a real commitment to the importance of Jewish education and ongoing lifelong learning in Jewish sources, then it creates real problems, real expectations that can't be satisfied. And for all, not just for the girls, but for the guys too who are involved, having to appear to be a learner when you're not, when a couple of hours a week is just fine for you, and really sneaking off, to appear to be more than that's a shame. So we haven't come to the terms of that yet. We've been using certain forms of social propaganda, to the lack of a nicer term, to do this, and it has had collateral damage. I think you're right. It has significant collateral damage. We have to rethink some of that in a serious way. You can't have most of your male population in Koyl for a long period of time. It just doesn't go. They're sitting there often twiddling their thumbs, staring off into the world and not learning anything. When I was there, it wasn't like that, and I've seen that it's changed. So I think it needs revisiting on the part of the people who are seriously committed to this.
Questions for Dr. Rosenfeld? You said at the beginning, really your first comments of the evening, that for our students who might be engaging in forms of sexuality, that there's room to sort of explain to them other aspects of the relationship in terms of perhaps chassidut or musar, things like that about midot. But what do you do with the halachic aspects with students? Like, how do you address those within a classroom or in terms of direct contact with students? Then is it just sort of thrown out because you're recognizing that this is what they're doing, or do we actually address it and perhaps instruct them in halacha and really what is our role?
Okay. So thank you for your question, because I think it brings out that what I personally was thinking about in terms of getting into the whole realm of sexual ethics wasn't students. I don't know if you're talking about elementary school or high school, but that was not the age that I was really thinking about. And I do think that at the elementary school and high school level, that is, I guess, of primary importance in terms of instructing them in what the halacha is and also the ethical aspect, so that you're giving them both. I think that sometimes when we're talking about singles in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and beyond, who know what the halacha is and know what the halacha says and simply are unable, for whatever reasons of, factors of their life, where they're at, they're not able to observe the halacha, I think that it's for those people mainly that sexual ethics is something that's very important to talk about, okay? Because I guess where my starting point was a population of people who know the halacha. They've learned the halachos of yichud, of negiyah. They've learned it in the sources. They've learned it out of the sources. And suddenly, they find themselves in a situation that they never thought that they would be in, where they're in a relationship and they see that they can't observe the halacha, or that something happens that creates that break. And at that moment, people often feel that Judaism has nothing left to say to me. Oh my gosh, I'm 26 years old, and here I've broken the halachot that I always thought I would keep. I've done X, Y, and Z, and now that's it. And I think it's for people like that in the singles community specifically, where a sexual ethic is very important. Obviously not meant to supplant the halacha, but really just meant as I guess, a bedieved, or an after-the-fact thing to say, look, it's still possible, even if you are violating the halacha in this stage in your life, to observe other aspects of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, or whatever that can be. So, thank you.
Yeah, I want to be
again commenting on this. First of all, a community that surrenders its ideals by building an educational system which doesn't teach what it takes to be ideal behavior is really in bad shape. So you have to continue teaching every piece of what you take to be the ideal kind of behavior. So I couldn't agree more about that everything that you said. But I want to stress again, the halacha demands more of people in the area of human relationships than nigiyah and yihud. And that has to be taught just as well to people who are in the fifth or sixth grade. The idea that people think that sex is about whether or not you close the door or not. Okay, that's one feature of Jewish sexual behavior, but it is by far the least important feature of what's expected. If you put all the halachic tshuvas on sexual relationship between men and women before and after marriage, during marriage, you will find a very small percentage of them compared, you know, are about technical details like that. Most of them are about responsibilities that people have. Okay, the halachas of onoah are about what happens in marriage and sexual relationships that take place in marriage, and people have to learn those halachas too. So the idea that somehow or other the halacha does not have ethical demands based built into it seems to me not correct and accurate. The halacha makes very many demands that we would think of as ethical demands on people, okay, that are not technical questions of nida. They are questions of responsibility for people sexually, for reproductive rights, and in addition, reproductive behaviors. All kinds of things are there. And all of the issues of not using coercion on individuals are not outside the halacha. They are found within the halacha. And one is not just being an ethical person by doing them. You are in violation of the halacha if you coerce your partner to sexual behavior, if you're not respectful of him or her, if you don't care what they feel, if you haven't learned how to do nice things for them, if you don't know how to behave on mikveh night, the fact that you went to the mikveh or your partner went to the mikveh is nowhere near sufficient halachically. And until we get it out of our heads that Judaism is not a technical set of religious, that the halacha is not a short form for, the halacha talks about nida. The halacha also talks about many, many other issues. Okay, and to pretend that it's merely an ethical question seems to me to be completely missed the point. The Torah speaks directly to these questions, and you're just as much in violation if you decide that you're taking a 1 week vacation because it gets you anxious, as you are if you don't count the right number of days.
Right. But at the same time, I think that I agree with what you're saying, and I'd love to see more of the sources where the halacha talks about that specifically, but I think that sometimes the nature of an ethical situation is that it demands a certain amount of thought or adaptation on the part of the individual that halacha as a system can't give you in the way that it gives you a shear for how much matzah you need to eat. Do you know what I mean? It's not that every unique situation that you're going to be in, you know, you can think of the passage in Shulchan Aruch that deals with it.
That's,
you know what I mean?
Yeah,
you can expand those Rashei Prakim into ethical modes of behavior that emerge from, you know, those halachic norms. But I don't think that the halacha can, by its very nature, cover all those situations.
That seems to me, I mean, you're right. That seems the notion that a set of rules is sufficient to govern all human situations is certainly wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay, but that's equally true of any shaila that you ask. The fact that most people ask black-letter law shailas about kashrus doesn't mean that there aren't sophisticated kashrus shailas. All the questions that we raised about education, almost all of human life requires very careful attention to how to make what you've learned in the Gemara, what you've learned in shailas and tshuvas, apply to specific cases. Okay, and that is a halachic skill as well, knowing how to apply halachat without just looking for some place where it's written what to do. Okay, is itself a halachic skill. So what you're saying would be equally true of any. That's what it is to be a halachic Jew, is to be able to take that material and find ways to look for unique ways to apply it to changing and constantly circumstances. That's true for questions of how much miser to give, whether or not it counts as miser if you pay for your kid's school education, how to deal with all kinds of difficult and emerging Shabbat questions, the extent to the roles of women in Judaism. All these questions have required us to rethink what the categories actually are.
And it seems to me that while it, I mean, it's not that I don't think there are ethical considerations outside of halacha. Sometimes there really are. Okay, but and there are cases where I would tell you that I would think the halacha has walked into a dead end and we don't know where to go. But I think there are much fewer than we imagine. And what it, if you take the system that governs your life, if you say that Torah doesn't really discuss these kinds of things and a person trained in halacha has no way to get at them, it seems to me that that's a mistake. Okay, and I, what I would say is, what I usually say is, well, give me cases. I would say, give me kind of, I can make up cases where, you know what, it'll be hard to make ethical choices too. We're constantly dealing with ethical dilemmas. If you think that ethics is about applying a single set of values, it's also, I think, naive. I mean, I taught in college for years, and I had to teach ethics to freshmen. That had nothing to do with halacha. But in teaching halacha, I teach a day a week in yeshiva. Okay, and we spend a lot of time on thinking through in what ways do the inherited texts and the halacha that's in them apply to continually shifting situations. So I don't think it would be any different in this kind of a circumstance. Okay, I think Chazal did that in the Gemara on a regular basis. They inherited, you know, you look at the, what the Gemara does with a Mishnah, trying to figure, does it apply to this case? Does it apply to that case? So I think it will advantage people for whom Western ethics is something they want to keep separate from Jewish influence. But I think it's just not true. And I would say I'd be happy to sit down with you any time and go over and say, let's look at 10 typical kinds of questions people ask about Jewish sexual ethics, and let's ask whether or not there aren't indeed many, many sources which bear on it. And do they apply exactly? Yeah, but no kashrus course and an interesting question applies exactly either. No shayla of ribis applies exactly. I mean, no shayla on Nezikin applies exactly.
Right. I mean, I guess our difference would just be with, in terms of what the texts are. Are they halachic texts, or are they, let's say, agadata from the Gemara, which can right. So I'm saying that's where we differ, because I would bring the Jewish text. It just wouldn't be limited to halachic texts.
I don't want to limit it at all. I agree with you. I'm not going to. I don't want to limit it. I don't want those texts to be left out.
Okay.
I just wanted to talk about it's socially acceptable today for intermarriage to take place, and 40 years ago and 50 years ago when there were signs at the beaches in Toronto, it said no blacks, no dogs, and no Jews. So my mother growing up in Canada, in the early 40s, you couldn't go to somebody's house who wasn't Jewish. They wouldn't allow you in the house. So certainly things have changed. The question that I wanted to mention is, when it comes to delayed marriage, how much is this an issue of the parents and not actually the children, where there's such great demand on the, you know, the kids might want to be, you know, go out with a certain person, but their parents, you know, disagree with that decision.
Can you clarify the question again? Tell me exactly what you're asking.
Well, there's a lot of pressure on marrying the right person. Mm-hmm. So coming from parents.
I mean, the extent to which parents are involved in the modern Orthodox community, involved in the shidduch process, is unusual. I mean, to the extent that they are very directly involved in managing the dates and deciding on who's appropriate or not. So, yeah, I mean, that's part of, in our practice, in my practice, part of what the work is beginning to differentiate how much is, you know, where the pressure is coming from, what the person really wants, and separating out where the pressures are and trying to sort all of that out. You're right. It's a very big point. Would you
agree with this thing? I agree with you. Yeah. I think it's a hard question. It's a very hard question. And
I mean, based on the people that I've seen, this is a more therapist comment than it is a rabbinic comment. I think learning to bracket what your parents' expectations are and make choices for yourself is an important stage in becoming an adult. And there are cases in which individuals simply have to push back very strongly and say to their parents, I'm going to do something of which you don't approve, and that's it. Mm-hmm. That has, I mean, I hate to be the bad bearer of bad news, but since I have five girls, and I tell all of them, at some point in your life, you're going to have to tell me that you're willing to do things I don't approve of. That's how life works. You grow up by learning to do things your parents don't approve of.
How are they doing?
They're doing fine.
Okay.
They're, you know, what you're hoping is that they won't pick something that's right at the center of, you know, your value core to decide that they're different than you are. But the bottom line is, we don't fall. The apple doesn't fall very far from the tree, but it isn't the tree. It's not the same. And part of growing up is learning to say, I'm making sometimes different choices on some issues than you are. And the smart parent respects that and makes room for that to take place and doesn't expect the kid to be a wind-up doll acting out what the parents have to say. The way the smart kid doesn't reject but something that a parent says just because it comes from your parents.
This is a rather pessimistic question, so keep in mind it's coming from someone who's single. In terms of our expectations that every person is going to get married, how realistic is that? Especially, I've spoken to people who grew up in a pre-war Europe, and they said there was always this issue of unmarried women, especially if someone couldn't afford a dowry, their prospects were basically nil. And are our expectations basically this American feeling of, you know, we all will be happy and have everything we want? Are these expectations, like, actually harmful? And can our schools be teaching, especially in the from girls' school, other ways to find fulfillment in life and just other, like, life ways? And
That's interesting. I mean, it's a very interesting, you're raising important points, and for sure, you know, one of the goals would be for communities to create more roles for single people within the community, and to create more of a sense of comfort for single people, so that they can feel that there's a role they could play. They could be on boards of shuls, they can have leadership roles in the community, and they can create meaningful lives no matter what their marital status is. So for sure, I think there is more of an attempt on the part of communities to incorporate singles, hopefully more and more. But you're right, there's a lot of work to do in that area. And for those. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No, I think it's something that's very important, but it's a balance that I think the community finds hard to strike between, educating that there will be some people who will remain single forever, and that's okay, and there's still ways to find fulfillment in life when you are single. I think that that's a message that the community might find threatening, because they feel like we're already in a shidduch crisis, so we need to get everyone married. How can we validate the fact that a single person might still have a meaningful life? Then we'll have no one getting married. Then where will Jewish continuity go? So there's all this fear that stops people from educating that, but it's definitely something that's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think you're really right. I can understand the community would jump out of their skin at this. And, you know, on the other hand, in a one-to-one relationship with people that I see in my office, I would say that your chances are better if you're older, and your chances are better you will get married if you stop thinking that life will be a disaster if you don't. You're better off if you believe that you can build a good life independent of whether you're married. And you're more likely to actually have a successful marriage if you feel that way. But I can understand, I think you're right. The community will have a hard time hearing this, even though I think it's the truth. Mm-hmm. And there needs to be some way, I'm not sure how to do it, there needs to be some way to if we can do this. Mm-hmm. I keep saying that people are getting married. What are we scared of? Yes, some people don't get married, but we're not in crisis that people aren't getting married. People aren't. The real crisis is for people who have to feel that, listen, I'm not getting married, and it's going to be okay. Which it is. Okay? Your life isn't over if you don't get married.
I'm just thinking, as you're speaking, that if this really is in some ways related to the whole issue of continuity and 12 million Jews and stuff, because as I'm thinking about it, it just doesn't occur to me that Christians speak in this manner. You know, they don't even worry about it. You've got, you know, a billion Catholics in the world. If we're not getting married, are we calling that a crisis, et cetera? So your question just sort of twigged something in my mind, that this really is somehow connected to this feeling of this kind of embattled minority, you know, fighting after, you know, the Shoah, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it really adds almost an unnatural weight to the whole issue. Okay. There's one before you. There's one before you.
somewhere in this there's a question, and I just want to address the idea before they were, Elliot, where you downplayed the idea of it there being a shidduch crisis.
I didn't like the word crisis.
Oh, okay. I think that we might be in a position of a crisis only from the point of I want to talk about or ask you something about a contemporary Jewish romantic crisis that we might happen to be in the midst of. Just a little bit of background. I'm a father of four unmarried children, 28, 26, 24, and 20. I happen to be the son of a Jewish mother and the husband of a Jewish mother and a Jewish mother-in-law I have as well. So I think our children are feeling the sense of crisis. None of them are married. One of them lives in the Upper West Side of Jerusalem, which is Katzimon. Two of them live in Washington Heights, and one lives here in Toronto. We hear constantly, a couple of 6 months or so ago, I went to visit one of my children in the shul on the corner of Bennett and 187th. The ticking, the biological ticking was deafening, coming from the women's side. The amount of shampoo that they spend for that 45 minutes of Kabbalat Shabbat, only to walk home at the end of the evening, frustrated because there's nothing else on the other side of the mechitza. We hear stuff, we hear talk about tefillin dates. Mm-hmm. I've heard stories about, if I don't get married by 30, I'm going to find a way to have a child of my own. We hear about early marriages, 19, 20, 21, coming along with early divorces a year or two later. There's a situation here in Toronto where there's a brothel that young men are attending, early marriage. They have a repository for tzitzis when the boys forget to put them back on as they leave this place. I think the point is that these kids, these young adults, are frustrated. They're stressed. They're uncomfortable. We are close to a crisis only from their point of view. Their reality is that they're in the sense of a crisis. So how do we help them? How do we get them through this? Rabbi Blanchard, your idea is that you will get married at some point, but that's not good enough.
Correct.
So how do we help them?
Okay. That's correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I know what you're all thinking about now.
Well, I mean, I agree. As you said, I think the fact that there isn't an objective crisis doesn't mean there's not a subjective crisis. And telling somebody, I said, nobody ever said that to, said, oh, thank you for telling me that, and goodbye. There really aren't enough places for people to talk about it. And somebody once said to me, how do you know that all the people you see get married? Sure, because they're talking to you for 18 months or 2 years. And that's possibly true. I mean, it may be that we don't have any place to have these conversations. What we have is people frustrated, upset, nervous. I said, and I think you're right. For them, it does feel like a crisis. And to pretend that it doesn't feel that way is naive. And yet there's no place to go to have that conversation and to talk it through and to try to think through what you're going to do. And so there's a sense of spinning your wheels in the face of a very difficult circumstance. And that's the most frightening thing in human life. If something's very important to you, but you feel like you can't go forward, most people are not easily equipped to cope with that. I mean, the correct advice is always, I did a lot of business consulting, is to tell people, don't just do something, stand there. Sometimes that is the thing to do, to stand there. But that doesn't make people, that's not going to be a long-term solution, and it's not going to work for people's feelings. And we don't have a way in the community. If somebody said to me, I'm very upset about this, what should I do? Who should I talk to? I've spent a lot of my time giving talks about this back on the west side of New York, especially about the kind of, I'll talk a little bit about some of these issues tomorrow in my talk about what relationship development is about and how you do it. But we haven't developed a system for doing it. The only people that get listened to are the people who are willing to go see a counselor in somewhere and talk about it. Otherwise, they just sort of talk to each other. And I gather from what my people that I talk to tell me, they talk in high-pitched tones, very nervously, as if it's really the most awful thing that's happening to them. And it's crazy-making. And we haven't addressed that at all. And that's not going to be addressed even by better means of meeting people. We're just not... I mean, in the end, I don't know what the answer is, but I know it's very strange that a community doesn't have any place for people to talk about these things. That seems odd to me. I think you're right.
I would just add also from the non-therapist perspective that it's so crucial that we find a space where the community can talk about this, because should everyone be in the therapist's office, you know, everyone hits the age of 20 or whatever that age is, decides that they want to get married, is that a sustainable thing, mm-hmm. you know, that everyone needs to see a therapist? I think we definitely need to find some sort of space of communal dialogue, because right once we have that conversation, it kind of makes it more manageable, and, you know, naming the monster, once it's speakable, suddenly it becomes mm-hmm. just becomes easier to deal with. Mm-hmm. So,
but I think there's also I'm just going to play the devil's advocate. I think there's also the phenomenon of the group panic and the sense of hysteria that if I don't have a baby by the time I'm 30, I'm going to, you know, do X, Y, and Z. And I think that, ironically, it's that in my experience, it's the people that don't have that sense of panic that are the ones that are perceived to be the most attractive to the opposite sex, people that appear like they're more, that they're kind of more at peace with where they are, often become the most attractive. And so there's a way, I think you're right, we have to, as a community, we have to find ways to address that panic, but at the same time to also often to try to limit that sense of hysteria and give people a sense that there are lots of ways to skin this cat, and there are lots of ways to do this, and it's not just one way, and if it's not a game of musical chairs where whoever's left standing is the odd one out, and that there are lots of ways to achieve their end.
And I was curious if you could comment on premarital relations past a certain age. I understand, you know, I get a lot of it today is stressed towards the younger age, but let's say someone over 40, 50. I have a lot of difficulty, you know, in accepting. The general premise seems to be past a certain age, like you're mature, this is a relationship, you know, why not type of thing. I go to a synagogue, I have a lot of problems that the rabbi wishes two people who are not married a good trip as they travel, you know, as they go away on a holiday. I see in shul a lot of couples who are together, they've been together for years, and they're not married, and they're a very accepted part of the community. And, you know, I live in a building where I see people coming and going. I don't want to sound like a prude, but I don't think, I can't see that as being right. And yet the general feeling out there is past a certain age, you know, like, what's wrong with you? I wonder if you could comment on that.
Oh, that's a hard one. I want to repeat, a community that surrenders its ideals is putting itself at great risk. So if you create the impression that we've lost those ideals at any point, I think it would be a significant mistake for us. We have to make that choice, and I don't think we shouldn't create a world in which we've given up those ideals by so normalizing their violation that nobody cares anymore. So that part, I think, I don't know the specific cases, because what happens is once you have ideals but they're hard to put into practice, you have to call everything case by case. Who do you lean on when? How do you create new possibilities for people that seem to be trapped, who, like you said, go on for years, and you're thinking to yourself, what's getting in the way of their, what's getting in the way? Come on, guys. So I can't, it's, I feel like it's handled on a case-by-case basis. The world that I live in, I don't live in your world, so I'd have to find out more from talking to you about it. The world that I live in, certainly the West Side, it's not normalized. In other words, nobody doing this thinks this is a long-term solution. It's fine. We won't get married. Big deal. Different, I guess, in Florida. People in their 70s are in different situations, but that's not what you're talking about either. So I don't know what to say. Once the community has asserted its ideals, I don't think I said there's a certain cynicism, and if you're referring to that, that should be dropped. I'm not interested in rabbis who, if you ask their opinion, say it doesn't matter. Of course it matters. You know, the Jewish tradition believes 100% in that the ideal relationship is a married relationship, end of story. There's no conversation about that. It's clear both halakhically and agadically that that's what where the goal primarily is. And if people give the impression that that's not true, they're not being faithful to the tradition from which they come, and they need to face that fact. It's okay. I can't stop them from doing it, but let's not be naive. And there I sympathize. I don't know what to do once we move into the situation of case by case. Sometimes people are, I don't know the cases you're talking about, so I can't comment on them. I would just say that any kind of public suggestion that this is long-term acceptable behavior would be a mistake for a community. It's different than privately accepting and working with people. Any kind of public endorsement would probably be a long-term, in my view, a long-term mistake. On the other hand, any kind of private judgmentalism would be an equivalently bad mistake. And what's the step in between them? Boy, I wish I knew. It's case by case for me.
I'm not sure this is the topic for this evening, but if we're dealing with human sexuality in the Jewish religion, it would be very hard-pressed not to deal with the homosexual and the lesbian issue that's been part of the Jewish community and more so in the Orthodox community in the past few years. And I'm just, either from a theoretical point of view or from a practical point of view, how is that being dealt with, or how do you think it should be dealt with? There may be two different questions there.
Yeah, the truth is that really isn't the topic tonight. So I'm gonna defer that, I'm gonna announce the program for tomorrow. We have three sessions tomorrow morning. We have one on creating intimate relationships. That'll be Rabbi Blanchard. Dr. Rosenfeld is going to talk about this double bind that we've been talking about premarital sexuality vis-a-vis the halakha. And the last session, I will be interviewing Adrian Gold and Jason Davis, who have a very particular story, journey that they've been on. That will be the last session of the morning. You're going to have to just tell me. We're going to give, all right, there's a request that the question be answered, so I'm going to give it a couple of minutes, so go ahead.
Was your question how it's being handled by the rabbis, by the community, by the gay people? On what level are you asking?
My question is the theoretical, the practical of how it's being dealt with, and the theoretical how you think it should be dealt with. Mm-hmm. And I think those are probably two different answers.
Right. Well, it's pretty recent that the issue is on the table. You know, since a few years ago, the movie Trembling Before God came out. It was a documentary about the topic of the struggle of Orthodox gay and lesbian people. And since the movie came out, I think there's been, the film's been widely received throughout the Orthodox community, and people have begun to talk about this in a way that I think 10 or 15 years ago or 20 years ago, you wouldn't have been asked this question in this kind of a context. So the good news is that people are talking about it and thinking about it. And I think it's going to take some time for the rabbinic authorities to begin to digest the stories that are now surfacing, and my thinking is that in the next 50 years, I think there will be some significant responsa that will offer us new ways to think about it from a halakhic perspective. And there are some thinkers that are beginning to write about this. That they're not mainstream thinkers, but Rabbi Steve Greenberg wrote a book on it, and there's more and more writing. Rabbi from England, Chaim Rappaport, wrote a book on it. So there's more and more writing being done. I know in more rabbinical schools like YCT, Yeshiva Chov Torah in New York, where they're training open Orthodox rabbis, the rabbinical students are being trained in these kind of questions and talking to gay Orthodox people and listening and hearing the stories and struggling with these questions. So I think the good news is that the questions are being asked and talked about. And I think in terms of the practical, what are the lives of the gay, there are more and more communities, small sub-communities being forged in big cities where gay Orthodox from people are remaining from, and they're having Shabbases and Yentifs, and they're creating worlds with other gay and lesbian people with whom they could share their a similar experience. And there are more and more couples, actually, that they're are marrying, you know, building lives together and raising children, and now these children of these couples are now entering into the yeshiva day school system, which is creating, of course, new questions for day school educators. How do you should one accept the child into the system? What issues does it raise in terms of the other children in the class? All of that. These are all cutting edge questions, but they're interesting, and it's an exciting process to watch. Because I think the new mores are being challenged. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Let me see if I understand the question correctly. You're asking whether they're going to talk about in the school system homosexual relationships and gay sexual relations. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's 100% correct. Mm-hmm. That's 100% correct. I just want to add one, plea, especially when it comes to educational situations and how much space there is in them for kids who are discovering homosexual or lesbian feelings. There needs to be enough space for people to be able to actually not feel that they have to hide out completely. I'm not sure how to do that. I know that the consequences in public school contexts are really negative. I ran an Orthodox high school for 8 years. As far as I knew, there were no gay or lesbian people in that school. That was not true. Because I left the school, I came to New York, I began teaching, and I met those people later on and discovered that that was not actually the case. There were gay and lesbian students in the school. Some of them handled it better than others, but for some it was a really difficult, painful, isolated, at-risk kind of existence that they should not have had to lead. And whatever we think in general, we have got to be there for the people in our community. Not we talk about it for the singles, but it would be true here that people don't feel abandoned and pushed out and forced to be to hate themselves for who they are. There's got to be an alternative to that in an Orthodox community too.
Mm-hmm. I just want to add one thing to the issue of, I'm glad that you raised this, because I was thinking about this as we were talking before about the question of sexual experimentation outside of marriage for single people. And to the extent that from gay people don't have a chance to experiment, it leaves this question open-ended for them, and it's harder for them to kind of, and in my practice when I work with them, it's harder for them to come to terms with the question, am I or not gay, because they haven't had any sexual experiences at all. And as a from therapist, it's often a dilemma that I face in terms of what from a therapeutic perspective, sexual experimentation would be advantageous, because as they begin to explore who they are. Of course, from a firm perspective, that's more problematic. But it's an important question to be raised, because also for our girls, in terms of when our girls are dating guys and they're shomer nagia, and this question is not understood enough, it puts everyone in a precarious position, both the gay man as well as the person whom he'd be marrying, in an attempt to reconcile these questions. So as a mother of girls, I think it's an important question to think about. I think it's on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you very much for coming.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.